Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank, focused knowledge, customized solutions, and the resources of an entire bank. Because the best solutions fit around a business's needs. More at key.com/corporate. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The web is a many-splendored thing. You can watch movies, read the newspaper, file court papers online. But don't forget to black out the parts you don't want anybody else to see. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, online at shrm.org. And by Bank of America, through community outreach, philanthropic giving, and environmental efforts, finding opportunity and embracing it. Bank of America, Bank of Opportunity, bankofamerica.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Wednesday, the 15th day of August. Government regulators have let the organic cows out of the barn, so to speak. Some trade secrets involving the country's leading natural food chain aren't so secret anymore. The Federal Trade Commission filed papers with an antitrust court that's reviewing Whole Foods' proposed takeover of the Wild Oats chain. Those papers were accidentally left exposed on a court website, and the AP got hold of them. Industry analysts might not be surprised by the revelations, but they do provide a glimpse into how Whole Foods is playing hardball against Walmart. Marketplace's Bob Moon has more.
The FTC is trying to stop Whole Foods' planned takeover of its smaller competitor Wild Oats Markets. The agency filed papers yesterday and blacked out parts of the electronic documents, but the AP found a way to read those sections, essentially undeleting them. The regulators discussed closely held marketing strategies used by Whole Foods. For example, the chain negotiates ground rules with its suppliers, barring them from selling directly to Walmart. The feds say that makes it more expensive for Walmart to go through distributors.
Well, that's capitalism. That's what we do here in America.
Industry consultant David Livingston says every company bargains for the best price, and forcing up costs for the competition should come as no surprise.
Perhaps they wouldn't like the public knowing about this, but behind the scenes, all companies are knowledgeable of what goes on.
Livingston thinks the strategy is an effective weapon against the Walmart juggernaut. It means the giant chain that prides itself as always having the lowest prices might not when it comes to organic foods. Industry consultant Frank Dell says suppliers are probably already plenty loyal to Whole Foods, which has spent years selling their goods. It might not take much to persuade those suppliers that Walmart isn't their friend.
They're continually looking for a lower and lower price, and is that the best interest of the supplier?
Maybe not, but in this case, the FTC is looking out for the consumer. It's arguing if Whole Foods can gobble up Wild Oats Markets, it could have even more influence over prices. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
$300,000 for a screenplay? That's enough to set dollar signs rolling across the eyes of half of L.A. But what if the movie you write makes, say, $50 million? Want a piece of that action? The industry Bible Variety reports that one major studio is rethinking the way it pays screenwriters, at least some of them. Oh, that this might spare all of us from Rush Hour 4. Here's Marketplace's Lisa Napoli.
A dozen of Hollywood's hottest writers have snagged a deal with 20th Century Fox. It's unusual because it'll allow these writers to give their input as producers, and it'll also give them a slice of the profits known in the business as gross points. That's the kind of deal usually offered only to A-list actors and hotshot directors. UCLA screenwriting professor Richard Walter says it's high time writers got a break.
It's miraculous. It's just miraculous and very positive, I think, for writers. Because as soon as you have a gross participation in something, you are a partner in that enterprise.
Now, you'd think if you'd written cash cows like Shrek or Little Miss Sunshine, studios would be falling all over themselves to offer you the best deal possible. Hollywood watcher Nikki Fink says the sad truth is that in Tinseltown, writers are at the bottom of the food chain.
They're treated worse than the guards in the security shacks.
Fink says the studios make fewer films each year, so they're not buying as many screenplays anyway. Because of that, she doubts what the screenwriting cabal has negotiated will yield many new movies or much cash. Fink says if these writers really want to take control of their fortunes, they should go directly to the net.
Frankly, right now, you would be better served if you cut your screenplay down to 15 minutes, you shot it with a bunch of friends in your basement, and you put it on YouTube.
After all, that's where Hollywood's trolling for the latest talent these days. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
Have you seen the YouTube clip of that lady who just got her first iPhone bill from AT&T? 300 pages delivered in a box? We all get fed up with our phone bills, especially those endless taxes and surcharges. But some iPhone users are getting more than they bargained for, and they're a little irate. Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
Tyler Dickman just got his first iPhone bill. It's 49 pages long.
I mean, this is the first bill where I couldn't put a staple through it in order to file it away.
As for why it's so lengthy, even though Dickman is paying one price for unlimited calls and data use, the bill breaks out line by line every call, text message, and web page download in text speak. He says it's just not useful.
I mean, when I look through this bill, am I ever going to say, oh, on July 12th at 10:03 p.m., I didn't use 2 kilobytes of data?
AT&T Wireless spokesman Mark Siegel says the company's a little surprised by all this fuss.
We're not doing anything differently here than we do for all our other plans, all our other phones.
Siegel says AT&T always breaks down usage information. He says AT&T gave iPhone customers the option of receiving an online bill as soon as they signed up. They can also opt for a less detailed paper bill. Adam Zowell of InMobile.org says what may seem like information overload to some makes sense from AT&T's perspective.
What they really don't want to get are a lot of customer care calls. Those are very costly for them, and what the customer care calls are normally about are the bills. So if you send them a big itemized bill, well, you know, that's more likely to answer the questions for them.
He says surprise over the extensive bills comes down to a culture clash, with functionality-obsessed Apple fans pitted against the old-school mindset of a phone company. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
And we've got a link to that YouTube video we mentioned on our website, marketplace.org. On Wall Street, all those gains the S&P 500 boasted this year, bye-bye. Same for Dow 13,000. Details when we do the numbers. Reports out today say the Bush administration is taking steps to list Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps as a terrorist organization. If that happens, it would be the first time the U.S. puts a foreign country's military on the list. The move would allow U.S. officials to further tighten the screws on Iran because the Revolutionary Guards have substantial business operations. And it would also put further pressure on other countries still doing business with Iran. Marketplace's Stephen Beer joins us to talk about these developments. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Tess.
So my first question for you, the Revolutionary Guard in Iran has time for business interests?
Plenty of time. It has a vast business empire. I mean, this may be a military organization, but we're talking about a very wide swathe of businesses, oil and gas, pharmaceuticals, telecommunications, carpet manufacturing.
Carpet manufacturing?
Absolutely. Carpet manufacturing and exporting. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard are heavily into that. It's virtually anything that you can think of. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard have got either a share of that business or they run it directly.
All right. Then what effect could this potential action by the administration have on the Guard?
Well, the U.S. is hoping that it's going to essentially just pile the economic and political pressure onto the government. It'll be one more thing in addition to the U.N. and the U.S. sanctions. The UN sanctions are aimed specifically at members of the regime and individuals involved in the nuclear program. The US sanctions are far more wide-ranging and punitive, and they've been pretty effective, actually, in persuading European banks in particular to pull out of Iran, to stop financing Iranian trade. This new measure, it's hoped, may make foreign companies even more reluctant to trade with Iran because they might be dealing with the Revolutionary Guard, a U.S.-designated terrorist organization.
So who is still trading with Iran anyway? There have been these sanctions for years. And how could this move affect those trading partners?
Well, first of all, who's trading with Iran? China is the country's biggest trading partner. Germany and Italy are still relatively big suppliers of industrial equipment and other goods. Britain, the U.S.'s closest ally, still does about $2 billion worth of business a year with Iran. Now, some of this business will undoubtedly decline as a result of this measure. How much? Difficult to say. Depends really on how effective the U.S. is in identifying companies that deal with the Iranian Guard and how punitive the Americans are in punishing them.
All right. Marketplace's Stephen Beard with us from London. Thanks, Stephen.
Okay, Tess.
Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, Galbraith's The Affluent Society. If a good old-fashioned bodice ripper isn't your thing, perhaps you'd like to try one of those. All week, we've been running suggestions from our commentators on the best business beach books out there. Books that won't make you sleepy, just smarter while you dig your toes into the sand. Commentator and writer David Frum offers up a classic that's all about the markets right now.
Life, as the signs in the liquor store say, is too short to drink bad wine. And summer is too short to read bad books. So soak up Charles Dickens' midlife masterpiece about wealth, class, business, and finance, Little Dorrit. In Little Dorrit, non-work is the root of all evil. Aristocratic scorn for work, bureaucratic obstruction of work, plain old lazy shirking of work, and the speculative hunger for wealth without work. At the center of the novel is a great speculation headed by a banker named Myrtle, described in the text as the master spirit of the age. There never was, there never had been, there never again should be such a man as Mr. Myrtle. Nobody knew what he had done, but everybody knew him to be the greatest that had appeared. Dickens offers few details of Myrtle's schemes. Indeed, it's not clear that Myrtle himself ever really understood them. But others convince themselves, for no very good reason, that Myrtle will make them fabulously rich. Read it first, like many epidemics, in the wickedness of men, and then disseminated in their ignorance, this speculative mania gets communicated to many sufferers who are neither ignorant nor wicked. It all goes bust, of course. Victims furiously blame everyone else for their own cupidity. Only the hero, businessman Arthur Clennam, reacts with integrity. "If the money I have sacrificed had been all my own, Mr. Rugg," Clennam sighs to his lawyer, "I should have cared far less." "Indeed, sir," says Mr. Rugg, rubbing his hands with a cheerful air. "You surprise me. That's singular, sir. I have generally found, in my experience, that it's their own money people are most particular about. I have seen people get rid of a good deal of other people's money and bear it very well. Very well indeed. A lot has changed between Charles Dickens' time and ours, but not that."
David Frum is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Got a favorite beach book with a business twist? Share it with us. We're posting listeners' recommendations on our website, marketplace.org. Couple of picks that just came in: The Pearl by John Steinbeck, The Pit by Frank Norris, and Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins. Coming up, a long, dry summer sparks fires and fears in the outdoor tourism market.
What we're looking at now is we're going to have a bunch of outfitters that are going to be heavily impacted by this.
But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks on Wall Street kept their downward spiral today, led by financial services firms. The Dow dropped 167 points, more than 1.25%, to close at 12,861. The Nasdaq fell 40 points, 1.6%, to 2,458. The S&P 500 slipped 19 points, 1.3%, to 1,406. Banks and other lenders took the brunt of the financial pain again today. Countrywide Financial's shares tumbled nearly 13%. Lehman Brothers shares fell 3.9%, and Goldman Sachs slid more than 2.8% today. Macy's marked down 2% after the retailer posted a 77% plunge in second quarter profits. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation. Want to know what's in the works at Marketplace? How about getting the latest news and features in an email? Sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It will keep you up to date on the day's business news and let you know what to expect on our next program. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link on the right.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Thursday. The Commerce Department reports on new home construction for July. The Population Reference Bureau releases its 2007 World Population Data Sheet. It includes demographic, health, and environmental information for all countries. They'll also discuss malnutrition around the world. And Viking releases a 50th anniversary edition of a Beat Generation fave, Jack Kerouac's On the Road. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund in for Kai Rizdahl. Time for your daily subprime mortgage mess update. The housing slump is now being called the worst in 16 years. Sales of existing homes fell in 41 states, according to the National Association of Realtors. There's word today that the subprime meltdown is spreading to small banks, not just the big national ones. To release the pressure valve, some in Congress and the mortgage industry want the government to allow Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to buy up bigger loans. So far, no deal. Stacey Vanek-Smith reports on how that's affecting potential home buyers in some of the country's most expensive housing markets.
This is a master bathroom. It's got a jacuzzi tub with a fireplace. And
real estate agent Dan Arguella shows off the finer points of a six-bedroom home in Manhattan Beach, California. The asking price is $2.7 million. For most of us, buying it would mean taking out a jumbo loan. That's anything larger than $417,000. Last week, interest rates for the average jumbo mortgage jumped 0.25%. Rates for smaller loans barely budged. Funny thing is, almost no one defaults on a jumbo loan. Housing market economist David Luray explains why lenders are punishing the good.
The lender community got caught with their financial pants down, and now they're afraid to make the loans. A lot of households that do have the financial wherewithal to purchase the homes are now unable to do so.
Mortgage lenders can sell smaller loans to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and pass the risk to the federally backed agencies. But when loans top $417,000, Fannie and Freddie can't buy. The government put restrictions in place last year when regulators worried Fannie and Freddie's shaky accounting and multi-billion dollar debts were putting the economy at risk. Now private lenders worry they won't be able to resell jumbo loans. That's a serious problem in cities like Los Angeles, where the median home price is well above $500,000.
People are very interested in buying. People still want to buy. The problem is, can you get them financed?
L.A. mortgage broker Mitch Olbaum says jumbo loans make up about 95% of his business, and many of his clients are middle-class buyers. Olbaum says just last week, a lender offered his client one rate and then suddenly jacked it up by 1%, a difference of thousands of dollars a year.
And I'm not happy with the rate. He wants to buy the house. He's been renting, he's been saving, he's been doing everything he was told to do. He has immaculate credit, he's got money in the bank, and this should not be a problem for a guy like him. Somebody like that is going to probably not be able to buy a house because of this.
Olbaum says more than 10% of his deals have fallen through in the last few weeks, up from less than 1%. He says many people just can't get the loans they need. The same thing is happening in New York, Boston, and San Jose. But if you're living in an area where homes are less expensive, should you care? Columbia Business School's Chris Mayer says yes.
You know that things are in trouble when healthy businesses and healthy borrowers can't get credit. This means the people who can and should be doing business won't be. When credit markets start to be a hindrance in the economy, you know, that's when things are really a problem.
Mayer says a lot of the priciest real estate markets, like Silicon Valley and New York City, are major economic engines for this country. He says if people there stop being able to buy and sell homes, they'll stop buying and selling other things. And he says that would have one jumbo impact on the U.S. economy. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
There are lots of boogeymen in the subprime crisis, lenders and brokers who handed out ridiculous mortgages, investors who bought into those mortgages, even the homeowners who signed them. And here's another one, the credit rating agencies. With us to explain how they fit in is Kim Clark. She's a senior writer with U.S. News and World Report. Hey, Kim, glad to have you on the program again.
Always a pleasure to be here with you, Tess.
Let's talk a little bit about what exactly is the role of the rating agencies in this subprime mortgage mess. What did they do?
Okay, the rating agencies are about three companies, and I do mean three, just three, that control about 95% of all the debt ratings in the country. And what they do is they take a look at almost every bond. And they say, yeah, this is pretty good. This is probably going to pay off, so we'll rate it investment grade, which is AAA, AA, all the way down to a couple of Bs, three Bs, I think. Or they look at it and they say, wow, this is a really risky venture. We're going to rate it what we call junk status or below investment grade.
And we're really talking about Moody's and S&P, right? Standard & Poor's.
Moody's and S&P, actually, the big two control something like 75 to 80% of the market. So they're the big dogs.
All right, so that's what the rating agencies do. So why are they now kind of in the middle of all the brouhaha about the mortgage mess? What was their role in all of this?
Odds are most people are going to pay their mortgage, right?
Mm-hmm.
We investors are counting on them to tell us just how risky the bonds truly are. Well, it turns out that they were using models that indicated that, you know, a certain percentage of these subprime loans wouldn't pay off, and it's turning out maybe those were a little over-optimistic.
This certainly isn't the first time that the rating agencies have come under scrutiny in what's essentially a bit of a scandal on Wall Street when Enron imploded. Everyone was like, wait a minute, where were the rating agencies?
Exactly. And this points out the two or three big problems with the rating agencies. The first is how they get paid as a result of who pays them, the issuers. Mm-hmm. They're a little too cozy sometimes with the companies and the issuers. Secondly, they're almost entirely unregulated. And thirdly, they don't always do as much digging as you and I would hope. In the Enron situation, Enron was called investment grade until something like 4 days before it went bankrupt.
Yeah.
So they were very slow to pick up on that. I think at one point, the chairman of Moody's was on the board of WorldCom, right? So you'd think he would have a little inside notice as to the company's troubles. But of course, Moody's and S&P didn't really pick up on that until it was a little too late. So there's been a coziness problem, just as we've seen with the Wall Street analysts and the accountants. It's the very same situation.
So why aren't the people who've lost money in this mortgage implosion, why aren't they speaking up about this?
Some investors are very angry, but, you know, a lot of very sophisticated investors know that they were supposed to be doing their own due diligence.
Mm-hmm.
The credit agencies, you can go to their websites, there's a very clear disclaimer that they place right up front saying, look, you know, this is just our opinion. We didn't really necessarily go look at the actual underlying loans. You know, we issue literally tens of thousands of ratings a year, right? So they don't have time to do the kind of digging that we all might like for every single one of them. So the investors sort of knew it was kind of caveat emptor, and maybe they shouldn't have been relying on them quite as much as they did.
Kim Clark is a senior writer at U.S. News and World Report. Kim, thanks again for joining us.
You bet, Tess.
Here in the West, we've been warned that this could be one of the worst fire seasons ever. Residents of Lake Tahoe already suffered, and now 5% of the state of Idaho is on fire. In addition to the damage to property and wildlife, smoke and flames have forced the Forest Service to close two popular stretches of the Salmon River. And that leaves quite a few businesses up a creek. Elizabeth Wynn Johnson of Northwest News Network reports the economic ripple effect is just getting started.
Fire crews call it a blow-up. Last week, in the midst of Idaho's dozen or so active wildfires, two separate blazes converged into one and headed straight for a group of 14 tourists and five guides floating down the Salmon, the part nicknamed River of No Return.
And that evening, it made a huge run upriver, covered in about an hour what they expected it to do over 4 days.
Allison Steen is an owner of Yellow Jacket River Guides in the central Idaho town of Salmon near the Montana border. Once she knew her people were safe, a different sort of worry set in.
I was saying to myself on the day that our guests came out, I said, this will be the most expensive day in the history of our business.
When your livelihood relies on wilderness access, acts of God come with the territory. Still, Idaho's river-dependent businesses have been scorched by this year's wildfire season. At roughly $20,000 a pop, canceling a rafting trip is a big deal. There are 35 outfitters who work this section of the Salmon. At times like this, they stay in close touch with Forest Service managers.
Hi, this is Mason Cabert with Cabert River Adventures.
Cabert is one of those outfitters,
yeah.
And he makes this call to check the status of the river. He's hoping for business as usual.
Okay, thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Yeah, they officially closed it. So that changes everything. What we're looking at now is we're going to have a bunch of outfitters that are going to be heavily impacted by this.
For the Whitewater faithful, Idaho's Salmon River is like Mecca. Closing it affects scores of businesses that rely on their yearly pilgrimages. The state's industry association says rafting, fishing, and hunting contribute some $50 million annually to the rural economy in Idaho. When wildfires shut down the river for 3 weeks in 2000, it cost the industry several million dollars. It's too soon to tally the impact for this year. Allison Steen of Yellow Jacket River Guides says her business will make it. In cases of natural disaster, the company offers rain checks, but not refunds.
And that for us is kind of the difference between a really huge hit when something like this happens and something we can survive.
There is a silver lining to the clouds of smoke hanging over the Salmon River. Rafters who made it through the steep-walled canyon before the closure got a rare glimpse of nature's crucible in action. Many have already booked future trips to see how the forest bounces back. In Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, I'm Elizabeth Wynn Johnson for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a diversified approach to fixed income can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, the Simon Cowell scowl has arrived on Wall Street. It's just awful, terrible. Can't carry a tune or a buyout. The New York Times reports shares of CKX, the company that owns the American Idol franchise, are down 25% from their high in June. That's got CKX's chairman thinking twice about taking the company private. He's still got one hope of topping the profit charts, however. CKX also owns the image and likeness of Elvis Presley and may be opening a king-themed hotel in Viva Las Vegas. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 167 points, more than 1.25%. The Nasdaq fell 40 points, 0.7%. The S&P 500 dumped 10 points, 0.7%. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Phil Richards, Joel Stein, and Tim Bamba are our engineers. Next time, a Cambodian woman builds an empire on silk and shreds expectations.
We compare Asian woman with moonlight in the family. I mean, soft, cool, quiet.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you'll join us again tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.